been listening to North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. And hello again, this is Randall Rickman, and I am reading to you from Time Magazine. The date for this issue is September 23rd, 2019. Time calls this the special climate issue, and so this issue does not contain regular features. We're going right to the beginning of the content. The section is called Viewpoint. The author is Al Gore, and the headline is Why I Have Hope for the Climate Change Battles to Come. This edition is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Al Gore writes, one of the important milestones in the struggle to build awareness of the climate crisis in the U.S. was the publication 30 years ago, by Time, of its historic Planet of the Year issue, focusing the nation's attention on our, quote, endangered Earth, unquote, prior to its decision to creatively adapt its Person of the Year brand to help mobilize public opinion in response to the unprecedented threat to the future of humanity. Time organized a 1988 conference of climate experts and policymakers to review the rapidly accumulating evidence confirming the warnings of scientists years earlier. All who attended felt it was the most impressive conference yet held to explore what many realized for the first time was an existential crisis. In the late 1960s, I experienced my own unexpected awakening to this planetary danger as an undergraduate in a college class taught by the legendary scientist Roger Revelle, who was among the first scientists to discover that human activity was adding more carbon dioxide to the Earth's atmosphere than nature could absorb. In 1965, Revelle had warned President Lyndon Johnson of the mounting crisis. Measurements made by Revelle's colleague, Charles David Keeling, from the top of Mauna Loa on the Big Island of Hawaii, showed clearly that the increased burning of fossil fuels was leading to a dramatic rise in the concentration of CO2 measurements in the atmosphere. 7 years after that class, as a young newly elected member of the U.S. House of Representatives, I asked what was being done about this emerging threat, and found the most common answer was, what threat? During my first ever congressional hearing on this crisis, I asked Dr. Revelle to be the lead-off witness, naively hoping when he spoke, those listening would have the same epiphany I had as an undergrad. When that didn't happen, I asked myself for the first time an urgent question that has preoccupied me ever since. How can this crisis be made as clear to our nation and to the world as Revelle made it to me? Nearly 40 years later, although we have made a great deal of progress, we are not yet gaining on the crisis. It is still worsening faster than we are mobilizing to confront it. The evidence is now even more overwhelming, of course, and Mother Nature has joined the discussion. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently issued its latest stark assessment, in which the world's leading scientists warned we must undergo an urgent and rapid transformation of our civilization in order to avert the most catastrophic effects of a disrupted global climate system. Humanity is now spewing more than 110 million tons of global warming pollution every day into the exceedingly thin shell of atmosphere that surrounds our planet, as if it were an open sewer. The extra heat energy being trapped on Earth and exacerbated by man-made climate change is now equal to what would be released by 500,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding on Earth every single day, according to James Hansen, a leading climate scientist. And the knock-on consequences of all that extra heat energy is leading to increasingly dangerous threats to lives and livelihoods all around the world. The past 5 years have been the hottest 5 years recorded since the world's top weather and climate agencies started tracking global temperatures in the 1880s. This past July was the hottest month ever in recorded history. More than 90% of the extra heat is going into the oceans, and it's fueling supercharged hurricanes. Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, all in 2017, cost as much as $265 billion in damages. Overall, weather disasters in 2017 and 2018 cost the global economy $653 billion, the costliest back-to-back years in history. Wildfires are worsening around the world, including across the American West, while farmers in the Midwest have dealt with periods of both catastrophic flooding and drought that destroyed crops and threatened the economic health of communities. Sea levels are rising at an accelerating rate as the melting of land-based ice in Greenland and Antarctica increases to record levels. The list goes on. But we must be on guard against despair, which is ultimately just another form of denial when the future of humanity is at stake. Yes, some losses are not recoverable. And yes, more damage is now inevitable no matter what we do. False hope is also a form of denial, but I remain optimistic that we still retain the ability to avoid the most catastrophic consequences of this crisis and save the future of humanity if we rise to the challenge and act urgently. My hope stems largely from the recent unprecedented groundswell of young activism that has raised public consciousness to new levels and is pushing political leaders to develop bold and ambitious ideas to confront this challenge. Harking back to the greatest social movements in history, women's suffrage, civil rights, gay and lesbian rights, youth activists are taking the lead. They are staging sit-ins at congressional offices, marching in the streets, and protesting on college campuses. Above all, a growing number of students in many nations have been striking from school every Friday for more than a year to demand action on the climate crisis. The movement has been led by a 16-year-old Swedish student named Greta Thunberg, who captured the world's attention with a groundbreaking speech at the UN's annual gathering of world leaders in Poland last year. Thunberg speaks with startling clarity about the threat her generation faces and how political leaders have failed the test of leadership. Her words and advocacy embody the moral authority of youth activists who will bear the burden of the decisions previous generations make today. Youth activists have also been at the ground level of the Green New Deal resolution. And there is more, but we are moving on in favor of getting as much material included as possible. That was Al Gore. Time says Gore served as the 45th Vice President of the U.S. Going forward. And this item is entitled, The Hottest City on Earth, by Erin Baker. She writes, it's just after 7 in the morning in the Pakistani city of Jacobabad, and donkey cart driver Asan Kosu is already drenched in sweat For the past 2 hours, the 24-year-old laborer has been hauling jugs of drinking water to local residences. When the water invariably spills from the water from the blue jerry cans, it hits the pavement with an audible hiss and turns to steam. It's hot, he agrees, but that's not an excuse to stop. The heat will only increase as the day wears on, and what choice does he have? Quote, even if it were so hot, as if the land were on fire, we would keep working, unquote. He pauses to douse his head with a bucket of water. Jacobabad may well be the hottest city in Pakistan, in Asia, and possibly in the world. Kosu shakes his head in resignation. Quote, climate change. It's the problem of our area. Gradually, the temperatures are rising, and next year it will increase even more, unquote. The week before I arrived in Jacobabad, the city had reached a scorching 51.1 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 124 degrees Fahrenheit. Similar temperatures in Sahiwal, in a neighboring province, combined with a power outage, had killed 8 babies in a hospital ICU when the air conditioning cut out. Summer in Sindh province is no joke. People die. By the way, Sindh province, that is spelled capital S-I-N-D-H, Sindh province. To avoid the heat, tractor drivers in this largely agricultural area till the fields at night, and farmers take breaks from noon to 3. But if life stops every time the temperature surpassed 40 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 104 degrees Fahrenheit, nothing would ever get done. Quote, even when it's 52 degrees centigrade to 53 degrees centigrade, we work, unquote, says Mai Latifan Khatum, a young woman working in a nearby field. The straw has to be gathered, the seeds winnowed, the fields burned, the soil turned, and there are only so many hours in the day. She has passed out a few times from the heat and often gets dizzy, but, quote, if we miss one day, the work doesn't get done and we don't get paid, unquote. If the planet continues warming at an accelerated rate, it won't be just the people of Jacobabad who live through 50-degree centigrade summers. Everyone will. Heat waves blistered countries across the northern hemisphere this summer. In July, all-time heat records were topped in Germany, Belgium, France, and the Netherlands. Wildfires raged in the Arctic, and Greenland's ice sheet melted at a record rate. Globally, July was the hottest month ever recorded. Climate scientists caution that no spike in weather activity can be directly attributable to climate change. Instead, they say we should be looking at patterns over time. But globally, 18 of the 19 warmest years on record have occurred since 2001. I asked Kamalo Mora, a climate scientist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, who in 2017 published an alarming study about the link between climate change and increased incidences of deadly heat waves, if this was the new normal for Europe. He laughed. The new normal, he says, is likely to be far worse. It's likely to look something like Jacobabad. Scientists estimate the probable increase in global average temperatures will be at least 3 degrees centigrade by the end of the 21st century. That, Morris says, would mean 3 times as many hurricanes, wildfires, and heat waves. People won't be able to work outside in some places, and there will be increased causes of heat stroke, heat-related illness, and related death. In the U.S., extreme heat already causes more deaths than any other severe weather event, killing an estimated 1,500 people each year. A 2003 heat wave in Europe is estimated to have caused up to 70,000 deaths. Yet we still don't think of heat as a natural disaster on a par with, say, an earthquake or even akin to a terrorist attack, says Mora. Quote, heat kills more people than many of these disasters combined. Europe in 2003 was like a 9/11 every day for three weeks. How much more disaster do you want before we start taking it seriously? Unquote. Quote, if you want to report on heat, this is the right place to be, unquote. Anis, a security guard working for my hosts in Jacobabad, cheerfully informs me as I arrive on a scalding June afternoon. Pakistan holds the heat record for Asia, he says proudly, though he has heard that it gets hotter elsewhere. It does. But the world's highest recorded temperatures, in California's Death Valley, for example, usually occur far from human habitation. Urban enclaves, where dense construction, a lack of green space, and traffic congestion combine to create a heat island effect, are rapidly catching up. While Pakistanis regularly claim Jacobabad as the hottest city in the world, it depends on how you measure it. Various atmospheric science organizations use different metrics, and record-breaking highs have ping-ponged between Iran, Pakistan, and Kuwait over the past couple of years. After extensive research, the World Meteorological Organization announced earlier this year that Turbat, Pakistan, 900 kilometers or 560 miles to the southwest, could claim the title with a temperature of 53.7 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 128.7 degrees Fahrenheit, on May 28, 2017. Jacobabad may very well win the endurance round, though, regularly surpassing 50 degrees centigrade, or 122 degrees Fahrenheit, in the summer months. Most days, the Jacobabad district, population 1 million, suffers from power outages that can last as long as 12 hours. Even when there is electricity, few households can afford an air conditioner. Locals rely on traditional remedies, like Tadel, a supposedly cooling tonic made from ground poppy seeds mixed with spices, rose-flavored syrup, and iced water. They also dress right for the weather, the women wearing shalwar kameez suits made of cotton lawn, a light, airy fabric. The loose trousers billow out from the waist. The long-sleeved tunic protects the arms, and a scarf covers the head. The men wear something similar, though without the vibrant patterns. Kosu, the donkey cart driver, soaks his clothes in water several times a day, while tractor driver Nabi Books swears that the Sindhi pop tunes blaring from his open cab take his mind off the heat. 60-something Muhammad Ayub, who sports a red cap sprinkled with tiny winking mirrors in the traditional Sindhi style, recommends taking frequent rests under a tree. The only problem is that most of the trees in the area have been chopped down for firewood. Quote, sometimes when it gets above 52 degrees, I feel like my brain is rolling around in my head, unquote. It was never that hot when he was a child, he complains. Quote, we had more trees then. now the trees are gone, unquote. The only real remedy, says a local doctor, Abdulhamin Samru, is to stay hydrated and get out of the heat. Tadel is pure superstition, he says. Still, he drinks it. Quote, maybe it's the opium from the poppy seeds, unquote, he jokes. Quote, it makes me feel better, and everyone is addicted to it, unquote. Not even the night air offers much respite. The digital thermometer I had been carrying around with me registered 41.1 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 106 degrees Fahrenheit, at 10 p.m. Instead of mattresses, most people sleep on charpoys, low cots of woven leather that allow the air to circulate underneath the body. The solar panels that run fans during the day don't work at night. Kosu is one of the lucky ones. At night, he puts his donkey back to work, treading a circle that powers the ceiling fan. But someone has to stay awake to keep the donkey going, he says, so either way, nights are rarely restful in the summer months. What seems like the minor inconvenience of a restless night has widespread ramifications, however. Nick Obradovich, a research scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Media Lab, started looking at the mental health impact of climate change when colleagues noted a correlation between increased nighttime temperatures and suicide rates in the U.S. and Mexico. In tracking more than a billion social media posts across multiple platforms from people living in varying climatic conditions, his team found that hotter-than-usual temperatures correlated with worse moods and an increase in reported mental health difficulties. Quote, if I were to say that climate change simply makes you grumpy, it doesn't sound all that catastrophic, unquote, Obradovich says. Quote, but if grumpiness is one of the myriad social changes that result regularly from unusually warm temperatures, we should be concerned about the cumulative effects of these changes over time on the long-term well-being of our society, unquote. Humans are incredibly adaptive, but when it comes to heat, there is a limit. When the ambient air exceeds the normal body temperature of 37 degrees centigrade, or 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the only way to keep from overheating is by evaporative cooling, a.k.a. sweating. But when the humidity is high, sweating is less effective because the air is already saturated with moisture. As a result, the body's core temperature increases, triggering a series of emergency protocols to protect vital functions. First, blood flow to the skin increases, straining the heart. The brain tells the muscles to slow down, causing fatigue. Nerve cells misfire, leading to headache and nausea. If the core temperatures continues to rise past 40 degrees centigrade to 41 degrees centigrade, organs start shutting down and cells deteriorate. Mora at the University of Hawaii described 27 different ways the body reacts to overheating, from kidney failure to blood poisoning when the gut lining disintegrates. All can result in death within a few hours. Mora's team analyzed data on 783 lethal heat waves spanning 35 years in order to quantify which weather conditions pose the greatest mortality risk. It turns out the old cliche that it's not the heat but the humidity holds true. Even relatively mild heat, and we're skipping many pages of pictures here, even mild heat waves with daytime temperatures of 38 degrees to 39 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit to 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit, turn deadly when humidity exceeds 50%. In Jacobabad, it rarely does, but by 2100, some 74% of the global population will experience at least 20 days per year when heat and humidity reach that deadly intersection, according to some studies. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration estimates that increased heat and humidity has already reduced the amount of work people can do outdoors by 10% globally, a figure that will double by 2050. Quote, "I don't think people quite grasp the seriousness of the situation," unquote, says Mora. Quote, "An entire set of livelihoods depends on being outside. Imagine being a construction worker who can't work for 2 months of the year," unquote. In Pakistan, evidence of a climate crisis is easy to find. For the past few years, Pakistanis say, every summer has felt hotter, every drought longer, and every monsoon shorter and later in the season. Quote, "Before, it used to be 1 or 2 weeks of 50-degree days," unquote, says the nation's climate change minister, Malik Amin Aslam. Quote, "Now it is months," unquote. These kinds of temperatures are not just deadly, but also economically devastating. In a country surrounded by hostile neighbors, frequently targeted by terrorist groups, and perpetually on the brink of nuclear war with India, Aslam ranks climate change as the, quote, "most severe existential threat facing Pakistan today," unquote. His office estimates that climate change could cost the country anywhere from $7 billion to $10 billion a year in disaster response alone, never mind lost economic activity. And Pakistan is no different than anywhere else, he warns. Quote, "With a temperature increase of 3 to 5 degrees that we are now looking at, the survival of the world is at stake. We cannot run away from it," unquote. But to a certain extent, you can prepare for it. During the summer months, the Pakistani airwaves are full of public service announcements warning residents about the dangers of heat, symptoms of heat exhaustion, and how to take precautions. Hospitals have dedicated wards for treating heat victims, and packets of oral rehydration salts can be found at any convenience store cash register next to the candy. The only way to reduce heat waves would be to reduce global carbon emissions, but cities can make them safer by providing more green spaces. Anyone who has stepped under the shade of a tree on a hot day doesn't need science to prove that it's cooler. But according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the microclimate created by a few trees can reduce ambient temperatures by up to 5 degrees centigrade, parenthetically 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Pakistani businessman turned environmentalist Shahzad Qureshi has taken that idea a step further by planting what he calls urban forests in the city's two largest cities, Lahore and Karachi. He says these micro-parks help a city breathe and serve as natural recovery wards from the urban heat island effect. Right now, Qureshi's urban forests are privately funded, but he hopes they can become an example for smaller cities like Jacobabad, where government officials will see the benefits of growing urban forests over building yet another heat-trapping concrete behemoth. We're going to pause now and move forward to another article in interrupting this article so we can get more different material into this reading edition. Moving on, under the general heading of climate optimists and under a further subtitle invention is an article, a sidebar feature, written by Su Yin Haynes, and the subject is Miranda Wang. Wang is spelled W-A-N-G, may be pronounced Wong, Wong or Wang. Su Yin Haynes writes, 10 years ago, Miranda Wang went on a school field trip to a waste management facility and was shocked by the vast amount of plastic she saw there, destined for landfill. Now 25, Wang is CEO and co-founder of a Silicon Valley-based startup, BioSiflection, that transforms the most commonly used and unrecyclable plastics into new materials using pioneering chemical technology. And going back to the name of that company, it is spelled capital B-I-O, bio, and then with no space, selection. And selection here is spelled C-E-L-L-E-C-T-I-O-N, capital C, bio, selection. C-E-L-L is how she spells selection. Quote, plastics are just natural compounds and natural carbons tied together in an unnatural way. And once you disrupt that, you can use those natural building blocks to make anything, unquote, says Wang. Quote, we can make a product from plastic garbage that's not only useful in new products, but it is biodegradable and can break down, unquote. The company's pilot program with San Jose, California's waste management facility has already received accolades from groups like the UN Environment Program, and now Wang is setting her sights on other cities all over the world. That's the entire sidebar article by C.N. Haynes, and the subject is a person named Miranda Wang, spelled W-A-N-G, her company, BioSiflection. On the same page is an article entitled, Take a Walk on the Rewilding Side. Subtitle explains, 50 miles east of London, a stretch of reclaimed land holds a key to our future. Article by Sierra Nugent, Dateline, Wallasey Island, UK. Avocets, terns, and gulls swoop down onto Wallasey Island on England's eastern coast, searching for food between blades of grass ruffled by the summer sea breeze. Aside from the wind and the odd chirp or squawk, it's quiet. The kind of peaceful scene that seems like it's been going on for centuries. Yet 5 years ago, these wetlands didn't exist. The mud the birds have landed on once lay under the streets of central London. In 2015, as part of a railway project, a construction crew scooped more than 3 million metric tons of dirt out from beneath the capital, drove it 50 miles east, and piled it onto farmland on the coastline of the County of Essex. In summer 2019, a crane hoisted old heavy machinery out of the water, removing the last vestiges of human interference. Wallasey is the largest restored coastal wetland in Europe, an exemplar of a growing movement to, quote, rewild, unquote, land and return it to the way it was before humans began exploiting it millennia ago. By the way, here I will spell Wallasey. It is W-A-L-L-A, same word, S-E-A, Wallasey, all one word. Returning to the article, it's good for the birds, but it's also increasingly understood as crucial for ensuring a world hospitable to people. As water sloshes in and out of Wallasey's restored mudflats and salt marshes, carbon dioxide that could otherwise escape into the atmosphere and contribute to global warming gets buried. Quote, bits of decomposing leaves and seaweed come down rivers to the coast, unquote, explains Rob Field, a senior conservation scientist at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, which runs Wallasey. Quote, when it gets to the slow-flowing salt marshes, the carbon falls out of suspension and gets stored there in the thick, gloopy mud. Unquote. Ecologists say coastal wetlands like these are capable of trapping carbon up to 40 times faster per hectare than tropical rainforest. But over the past 400 years, farmland, coastal development, and rising sea levels have combined to destroy 91% of wetland habitats on the Essex coast. Worldwide, 35% of global wetlands were destroyed from 1975 to 2015, according to the UN. Scientists say it's too late to prevent catastrophic climate change by only reducing greenhouse gas emissions. As well as rapidly phasing out fossil fuels, the world also needs to deploy so-called negative emissions technologies to draw down large amounts of the carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere. Many believe that nature restoration is the cheapest and simplest way to do it. Other options, including machines that catch carbon as it's being emitted by power plants or suck carbon out of the atmosphere to store it underground, need research, money, and time to mature before they can be used on a large scale. For that reason, most Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change pathways for limiting warming to a 1.5 degree centigrade above pre-industrial levels rely on forestry and better land management to make up for the bulk of carbon drawdown over the next 30 years. To save the planet, we may need to give some of it back to nature. In Europe, home to some of the most densely populated land in the world, and where true wilderness has become almost non-existent, the idea of bringing nature back while also fighting climate change has captured the imagination. Dozens of privately and publicly funded rewilding projects have popped up across the continent. Europeans are reviving coastal habitats like Wallasey in the UK, reversing the drainage of peatland bogs in Germany, and replacing forests in the Scottish Highlands. The projects not only sequester carbon, but also boost biodiversity and help the land adapt to the changing climate by preventing floods and wildfires. Advocates of nature restoration say those benefits give rewilding an edge over simple tree planting, which has been popular with European governments for decades. From 2005 to 2015, Europe's forest cover grew by the equivalent of 1,900 football fields every day, as the EU spent several billion euros to fund tree planting, often on farmland, that had been abandoned because of changing agricultural practices in places like France and Italy. Some of that was reforestation, using native species to restore forests to what they were before, but much of it was so-called afforestation, the planting of many of one species of tree where there was none before in regular lines. Many afforested trees are regularly cut down and used to produce timber, paper, or biofuel. Rewilding advocates say afforestation, while offering similar carbon sequestration capacity to reforestation, offers little benefit to wildlife and carries risks. Studies have found that the large-scale planting of non-native trees in Canada and China have disturbed natural ecosystems, worsened wildfires, and depleted groundwater levels. Meanwhile, other landscapes have been neglected. Quote, I think politicians like planting trees because it's very clear, simple action, unquote, says Timon Rutten, head of enterprise at Rewilding Europe, a Netherlands-based NGO that oversees nature restoration schemes from Portugal to Bulgaria. Quote, but peatlands, wetlands, and grasslands are just as good, or sometimes even better, at storing carbon. Unquote. Northern European countries shelter large expanses of peatlands, sometimes called moors, bogs, or mires. Peatlands that perhaps offer the greatest opportunity for natural climate mitigation. The plants that grow on the surface of peatlands sequester or absorb carbon dioxide as they grow. When they die, the decomposing plants do not leach carbon back into the atmosphere, but get buried in waterlogged bogs, compressing into a new layer of peat, and peat is spelled P-E-A-T. These habitats cover about 3% of the globe, but contain more stored carbon than all other kinds of vegetation on Earth combined. For clarity, I will repeat that sentence. These habitats cover about 3% of the globe, but contain more stored carbon than all other kinds of vegetation on Earth combined. They sequester 370 million metric tons of CO2 per year. I'll repeat that for clarity. They sequester 370 million metric tons of CO2 per year. But 15% of the world's peatlands have been drained for agricultural use, or so that their peat can be burned to power generators, emitting carbon dioxide in the process. The dried-out peatland that's left behind then releases stored carbon into the atmosphere. Peatlands now account for almost 6% of annual global human-caused carbon emissions. EU-funded rewilding projects in Finland, the UK, and Germany or re-wetting peatlands to turn them back into carbon sinks. Rewilding advocates are competing for investment with more modern negative emissions technologies. Dozens of companies are developing carbon capture and storage, parenthetically CCS, technology, in which machines use chemical processes to filter CO2 out of the air. The gas is then used to make products or stored underground, removing it from the atmosphere. Swiss startup Climeworks, for example, scrubs CO2 from the air at plants in Italy, Switzerland, and Iceland at a cost of $500 to $600 per metric ton of CO2. It is then sold for use in greenhouses, soda manufacturing, and biofuel production, or stored in rocks deep underground. But most IPCC plans for preventing more than 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming include a different kind of CCS, bioenergy and carbon capture and storage. Parenthetically, that is all caps, BECCS, standing again for bioenergy and carbon capture and storage, BECCS, which should account for the majority of negative emissions by the end of the century. BECCS power stations burn trees and plants, which have sequestered carbon while growing, to produce electricity, then trap the resulting CO2 emissions. The UK government has invested $32 million in domestic BECCS projects, including the first pilot program to launch in the EU, the Drax power station in the UK, which went online in February. Currently, these high-tech methods for removing carbon from the atmosphere are expensive and so have limited reach. Rewilding, at least at the moment, is cheaper and more proven. Peatland restoration, for example, can trap a metric ton of CO2 per year for about $16. Despite the low cost, however, there are obstacles to rewilding on a meaningful scale. Unquote. A quote, rather. Quote, there's a limited amount of land that we can do restoration on, unquote, says Simon Lewis, a professor of global change science at University College London. The mudflats and salt marshes at Wallasea currently bury around 1,200 metric tons of CO2 a year, the equivalent of the per capita emissions of only around 200 Brits in 2018. The UK would need to rewild wetlands about 10 times the size of the entire country's land area to zero out national carbon emissions. Large-scale nature restoration also doesn't yet have real political support. The British government's current rewilding plans include just 500,000 hectares of land, 0.2% of the country's total surface area. Just 500,000 hectares over the next 25 years. And privately funded rewilding schemes often come up against resistance. One of the largest such projects, Summit to Sea, and that's sea spelled S-E-A, Summit to Sea, which calls for the restoration of ecosystems of 10,000 hectares of farmland in Wales, has attracted fierce opposition from local communities and agricultural groups, which fear no longer being able to use the land for their livelihoods. At Wallasea, the illusion of unspoiled nature was punctured on the July morning time visited by a plume of dark gray smoke above the island's north edge. The British military uses nearby land to dispose of expired ammunition, explains site manager Rachel Fancy. Quote, "We get a lot of big bangs out here," unquote. Nevertheless, Fancy says, she expects humans will find more ways to coexist with nature in the coming decades, especially as climate change threatens both. Rewilding doesn't just sequester carbon. It also reduces the risk of floods and wildfires, both of which are becoming more frequent on a warming planet. Over the next 100 years, Wallasey's salt marshes should creep up the sand dunes and act as a natural flood defense, protecting nearby homes and farmland, even as man-made walls are overwhelmed by rising sea levels and increased storm surges. Wallasey is doing its bit to stave off the worst of that climate breakdown as it buries carbon amid samphire and sea lavender. Meanwhile, the birds can relax here. The weather is fine for now. That was that entire article. At the end of the article, the page shares a sidebar with another version of Climate Optimists. And here the subheading is Law. And the title of the profile is a person named Tessa Kahn. Kahn is spelled K-H-A-N. Article written by Tara Law, who writes, in 2015, Tessa Kahn was living in northern Thailand and working on behalf of a women human rights nonprofit when news of a district court case more than 5,000 miles away caught her attention. A court in The Hague had ruled in favor of some 900 Dutch citizens and a group known as the Uganda Foundation, or the Urganda Foundation, which had sued the Netherlands, demanding that the state reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. Kahn realized the courts could be a powerful tool to fight climate change, and in the process, mitigate what she calls, quote, one of the biggest systemic threats, unquote, to international human rights. She moved to London and joined Urgenda, which is spelled U-R-G-E-N-D-A, Urgenda, where she now provides legal assistance to people around the world who want to take their governments to court over inadequate climate policies. She says she hopes the cases draw attention to the actions governments need to take to reduce the use of fossil fuels and to show how ordinary people will be impacted by climate change. That is the entire sidebar feature written by Tara Law. The person who is the subject of the article is Tessa Kahn. Now we go to an article entitled, Can We Innovate Our Way Out of This Mess? Written by Andrew Blum. Blum is spelled B-L-U-M. Time explains, Blum is the author of The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. He mentions several items. One item is entitled Next Generation Nuclear. Nuclear reactors have been providing zero carbon power since the 1950s, and today supply 20% of the U.S.'s electricity and 11% of the globe's. But safety and environmental concerns have increased the cost and complexity of nuclear power plants, and their construction has all but stopped in the U.S. Parenthetically, only one new reactor has come online this century. One strategy for reinvigorating the industry is to focus on smaller, simpler reactors that can be constructed in factories, produce less radioactive waste, and require less day-to-day management. Parenthetically, some will be designed to shut down automatically in case of disaster. We skip ahead to another item in this article. The title is Managing Carbon Sequestration. Almost all the scenarios outlined by scientists to limit the increase in global temperatures require not merely reducing the amount of carbon emitted into the atmosphere, but eliminating it. The technology to do that, known as carbon capture and sequestration, involves removing carbon from the atmosphere and either physically storing it, often underground, or leveraging natural processes that capture and store it, as trees do. Engineers have been working on the challenge for decades, but costs remain high, in part because there is no economic benefit to storing carbon. One way to change that would be to reuse the carbon as fuel. But that only delays its release. Another would be a price on carbon itself. For engineers, it's a tantalizing area of research, the ultimate moonshot, because any breakthrough in capturing carbon, reusing carbon, or storing it at a large scale would mitigate the potential catastrophe of allowing it to continue to heat the atmosphere. Life could not only go on, it could go on more or less as it has. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. And please be sure to listen next time. You've been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is your Time reader, Randall Rickman. Thank you once again for joining me and for your patience with your reader's mistakes. And this content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Randall Rickman, thanking you again, and we hope you'll join us next time for your Time Magazine.